The reading I'm going to do is actually going to be somewhere in the middle of the talk, but if you want to turn to the page for that now, you can. It's on page 855. It's Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Again, that's page 855, Luke chapter 1. I'll say it again when we get there. Thanks for taking a break from your Raisin Weekend revelries to come join us in church. I can't promise that I'm going to be more exciting than Raisin Weekend, but I think that what I'm talking about is vastly more important and weighty. Tonight, I've been given the topic to talk about whether or not the Bible is fact or fiction. I've chosen to focus particularly on the Gospels and, jumping off of the Gospels, on the resurrection, which the Gospels climax in, the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. The reason that I'm doing that is mainly because of time. I have a short time to speak. There are lots of good resources out there about whether or not the entire Bible is telling us what is historically true or factually true. But tonight we're focusing on the Gospels. The reason I'm doing that is because if the Gospels are telling us the truth about the fact that Jesus really did come back from the dead, then that means that Jesus is Lord over the whole entire universe, because death is humanity's greatest enemy. If Jesus really did come back from the dead, then that should change the way that we approach him and the way that we approach this book that speaks about him. So if Jesus really did come back from the dead, then we have reason to go back to the entire Bible, because Jesus said repeatedly that the whole Bible was about him. So tonight we focus specifically on the Gospels and on the resurrection. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 that if Jesus has not come back from the dead bodily, then Christianity is completely pointless, and Christians are utter fools. I'm wasting my time. Paul's wasting his time. 2,000 years of Christians have been wasting their time. If it's true that the Gospels are to be trusted in telling us that Jesus really did come back from the dead, then we have to approach the Bible differently. Christianity hangs on this question. It's not optional. History matters for Christianity. It's not just a religion that tells us how to live a nice life, how to find some principles that will help us have better marriages. Everything hangs on history in Christianity. But we live in a culture that scoffs at the idea that God would intervene in history. We believe, essentially, in our culture that the world is fundamentally material, that all there is in the whole universe is just matter, just some molecules bouncing around. The universe, in this worldview, this way of understanding the universe, is fundamentally closed. There's nothing intervening in it in the outside. Nothing can intervene in it. All there is matter, just molecules. On top of that, and with that, the universe is fundamentally impersonal. And what I mean by that is that there's no ultimate personal God who has created the world and is ruling it or controlling it in any way. Because of that, in this worldview, our own personhood is something that is really just self-created, or something that's been imposed on us by our culture. If we are to have any kind of personality, we have to create it for ourselves, or we just have to fit in with whatever our families tell us we are. Because at the end of the day, we're not really any different from trees or rocks. There's no such thing as personality. That's the basic worldview of our culture. And by worldview, what I mean is a set of questions to really basic, or a set of answers to really basic questions, like, where did we come from? Where are we going? What's wrong with the world? How do we fix it? Everybody, whether they realize it or not, has a set of answers to those questions. Most people don't think through them very carefully. But you really cannot function in any meaningful way without having some basic understanding of who we are and where we came from and what's wrong with the world. But like I've said, at the end of the day, the worldview of our culture is materialistic. There's only matter. And so in that kind of worldview, in our kind of culture, it's absurd to talk about the idea that someone could come back from the dead permanently, not just someone who maybe is brain dead for 20 minutes and then they come back, but someone who really comes back from the dead and doesn't die again. That's a really crazy idea in this kind of worldview. It doesn't make any sense because there's just matter and nobody's intervening in the world to do things like that. We take this for granted in our culture. All people have assumptions about the way the world works, even Christians. We just take things for granted and we build on top of them. But we have to evaluate our assumptions and figure out if they align with reality, if they align with truth, if they're consistent, if they make life ultimately meaningful. But what all this means is that for some of us, for some people, because they're committed to this materialistic worldview, nothing I say tonight about the Bible or about Jesus' resurrection will convince them. Because they're committed to this worldview that says that that can't happen. Nobody can come back from the dead. No amount of evidence would convince someone. People, when they have this kind of worldview, this way of evaluating the universe, they find some other way of explaining it, even if there's no evidence for it. They just say, well, I don't know, aliens came and rose Jesus from the dead or something. It doesn't fit in your way of thinking about the world. But some of us tonight may be willing to doubt our doubts temporarily. Perhaps some of us have experienced the meaninglessness of living in a world where there's no personality, where we're nothing more than molecules bouncing around. When you fall in love with your boyfriend at the end of the day, if all that is just some chemicals firing in your brain, maybe you're realizing that's quite meaningless. Maybe there's something more than that. It seems like there should be more than that. And so some of us are willing to doubt that. And so tonight I'm speaking primarily to you. If you're willing to step back for a little bit and think about the fact that maybe it's possible that there's an ultimate person out there above and over the universe who can intervene in it. Maybe there's more than just matter. Maybe there's more than molecules. And those are the people that I'm talking to tonight, that I'm appealing to listen to what I have to say. I'm going to give you evidence for that fact that the Gospels are reliable and that Jesus really rose from the dead, in hopes that you'll rethink some of these basic answers to these really basic questions about what the world is and what it's for. I'm arguing that the Gospels really are historically reliable when they tell us who Jesus was and what he did, and that he rose from the dead, and that God has actually helped the people to write that down in an accurate way, and that Jesus really is Lord of the universe because he's defeated death. So the first thing we have to deal with when we're talking about the Gospels, so we'll talk about Gospels and then resurrection. The first thing we talk about with the Gospels is the question of, are they authentic? Authenticity is the question of whether or not the Gospels we have today in our Bibles are the same Gospels that were written 2,000 years ago by some of Jesus' disciples. Have they been corrupted in the last 2,000 years? Or are these the ones, can we be confident that we're reading the same words that the authors wrote? I'm also going to talk about reliability. So authenticity says, are these the originals? Reliability says, are they truthful? Are they telling us what's real about the world? Those are two different questions. So the first question is, are the Gospels authentic? Do we have the same Gospels that were originally written, or have they been corrupted through political machinations of church history? I suggest that they are incredibly authentic. The New Testament is by far the most well-attested document of the ancient world. There are 5,600 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, and that's not counting translations that were made shortly after. A manuscript is a handwritten copy of an ancient document. There was no printing presses, so the only way they could make more copies was by having someone write it out by hand. There's 5,600 of these that we found of the New Testament in part or in whole. By comparison, the next highest number of manuscripts that we have for any ancient document is Homer's Iliad, of which we have 643 manuscripts. For another example, Livy's Roman History, written in the first century, the same time as the New Testament, has 20 manuscripts in existence today. Julius Caesar, who many of us have learned about at school, he wrote his memoirs about fighting the Gallic Wars in France and Germany. There are 10 manuscripts left of his document. So you can see by comparison, the New Testament is vastly much more well attested than any other ancient document. 5,600 compared to about 650 for the next highest one. By far more manuscripts than anything else. Besides the sheer number of manuscripts that we have in the original language for the New Testament, we also have lots of manuscripts that were copied very close to when they were originally written. We have a piece of the Gospel of John that was written within about 40 years of when John wrote his Gospel. We have most of John's Gospel in a manuscript that's about 100 years after John wrote it. That might sound like a long time, especially in our age where we can send emails and we can go read online about things that are happening on the other side of the world. But to give you some comparison with our other ancient documents that we've learned about in school, as if there's really no doubt about what they say, the next shortest time gap that we have between an original writing date and the earliest manuscript copy that we have is, again, for Homer's Iliad. and that's 500 years. So New Testament, we have manuscripts that are 40 years, written 40 years after the original. The next closest is Homer's Iliad, 500 years. Again, Caesar's Gallic Wars, the gap between writing time and earliest manuscript is 1,000 years. A lot can happen in 1,000 years as far as things being copied by hand. People make mistakes. So we have a lot of manuscripts of the New Testament, and we also have very early manuscripts of the New Testament. And to be sure, and maybe some of you have heard this, there are a lot of differences between the manuscripts of the New Testament. This just happens when people are copying things by hand. Even when you're doing things by email, you make all kinds of mistakes. Even modern printing presses make lots of mistakes. So there are a lot of differences between the manuscripts of the New Testament. But the vast majority of those differences are over very inconsequential things, like spelling, punctuation. There are very, very, very few significant changes in these manuscripts between each other. In over 99% of the New Testament, we can be 100% sure that we are reading the original writing. It's only in less than 1% of the New Testament where we aren't sure what the original is. And in those places, and we know where they are, I can point to you and say, here's a spot where we're not really sure what Paul originally said. None of those have any effect on any Christian doctrine or belief about who Jesus is or the early church or anything like that. So there are differences. I don't want to make it sound like somehow people were able to just copy without making any mistakes for 2,000 years. There are differences. But they were copied very carefully. Almost all of the differences are insignificant, and the ones that are significant don't affect anything about Christianity or what we understand about Jesus. So because of what I've just said, number of manuscripts, earliness of the manuscripts, the fact that over 99% of the text is, we can be confident that we're reading the original, I'm telling you that the Gospels are authentic. We know that we have the originals in front of us today. The bigger question is the question of reliability. I can authentically copy something, but it's a totally different question of whether or not it's true. Are the Gospels telling us what actually happened in history? The first question we have to ask when we approach this question of are the Gospels reliable is, what did the authors intend? Did the authors of the Gospel intend to tell us the truth? Or did they intend to give us some fables that aren't really historically true, but maybe tell us some nice things about how life works? Or perhaps, as a lot of people argue, maybe they were writing to deceive us. Maybe this was a political ploy in the early church. Jesus' disciples were trying to gain power over another group, and so they made up stories about Jesus. Do they intend to tell us the truth? I suggest that they do. If you have your Bibles open to Luke chapter 1 on page 855 of the Black Pew Bibles, I will read you an example of this where a writer tells us his intention. Luke chapter 1 on page 855, verses 1 to 4. Here's what Luke says. He's written the third gospel. He says to the reader, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." So you can see here that Luke tells his reader, this person named Theophilus, and by extension, all Christians, all people, he says that he intends to give a careful, orderly account of what happened. He's going off of what eyewitnesses have told him, what other people have written down as they've talked to eyewitnesses. He says he's doing this because he wants the reader to be certain of the things that they've heard. And you see similar statements in the other Gospels and in other parts of the New Testament. The authors intend to tell us the historical truth. They're not telling us fables. On top of that, there are other things inherent to the Gospels that suggest to us that they're telling us the historical truth. We have the author's intention, but we also have these internal characteristics that tell us that what they're saying is probably true. The first thing is that in the Gospels, Jesus' disciples are portrayed very poorly. As you read the Gospels, you will quickly see that the disciples are portrayed as being selfish, foolish, faithless, and confused. And these are the men and women who were starting the early church. Jesus' 12 disciples wrote the New Testament, where they were closely associated with people who wrote the New Testament. So you wouldn't, this is not what you'd expect from people who were trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes and convince everybody that Jesus really rose from the dead so that they would come and join their religious group. You wouldn't portray yourself so poorly in something where you're trying to convince people that your group was right. The second thing about the Gospels that suggests to us that they're telling us the historical truth is that they portray women as the first witnesses of the resurrection. In the ancient world, women had few rights. They were not taken seriously, and they were not permitted to testify in court. Their testimony was worthless in the ancient world. If the Gospels were made up, if these were just stories, political stories or nice fables, why would the early Christian leaders place women as the first witnesses in the church's most important event? There's nothing more important in the New Testament than the resurrection. And women, whose testimony means nothing in the ancient world, are the first ones to see it. That doesn't make any sense unless they really were the first witnesses, because nobody would have taken them seriously. The third thing that suggests to us that the Gospels are telling us the truth is that they have all kinds of historical and local detail scattered throughout that to us doesn't mean much to us. Sometimes they give you names of people. They say, oh, this is so-and-so, and he's so-and-so's dad, which to us we say, who's that? They don't show up anywhere else in the New Testament. They give us lots of little details about when things happened. For example, Luke tells us in his next chapter, chapter 2, he says that Jesus' birth took place during the time of a census that Caesar Augustus put out, you know, who was the great Roman emperor at the time. And he says, you know, it's the census that happened while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Luke and the other gospel writers are purposefully pinning these events into specific historic locations, very specific historic locations. They tell us there are certain kinds of trees that were growing in certain stories, all kinds of these little details that don't have much to do with the central story, that suggest that they're dealing with eyewitnesses and that they're talking about things that really happened and with real people that the readers of the first readers of the Gospels could have gone and talked to. The fourth thing that the Gospels suggest to us, that they really are telling the truth, is that they're giving us four distinct perspectives on the same events, on the same life of Jesus. Some people, and lots of people, argue that because there's differences between the Gospels, that they must be contradicting each other. Jesus feeds 5,000 people in one gospel. He feeds 4,000 in another gospel. A lot of people will say, well, this is a contradiction. They're just kind of playing fast and loose with numbers because they want to teach us some deeper truth. But I'm suggesting that the gospels do not actually contradict each other. John Feinberg, whose book I read in preparation for this talk, he gives this definition of a contradiction. He says, a contradiction is only a contradiction if there is an affirmation and a denial of one and the same thing at the same time and in the same way. There are lots of differences between the Gospels, but they are not making these kind of contradictions. The Gospels, one Gospel does not say, Jesus turned water into wine at Cana, while another Gospel says, Jesus did not turn water into wine at Cana. There's not those kinds of contradictions. There's differences. They overlap. Some of them talk about certain things that other ones don't. Some of them tell the same stories in different ways, but they're not contradicting each other. The point is that these four Gospels are not just distillations of the same early propaganda of the church, but that because they're giving us these four distinct and different and overlapping but not exact perspectives on the same things, that suggests to us that they're actually talking about things that really happened. They weren't mushed into the same exact mold, but they're distinct, and that helps us to understand who Jesus was better. So because of these four characteristics, disciples portrayed poorly, women are the first witnesses of the resurrection, lots of historical and local detail, and the Gospels are distinct and overlapping but talking about the same things, those four internal characteristics of the Gospels suggest to us that they're really telling us the historical truth, that we should take them seriously. These are not just fables. On top of that, internal characteristics, there's also external characteristics of the Gospels. There are many different ancient documents and historians who talk about the early church and talk about Jesus. So you can't just say, well, you know, well, this is religious stuff, and of course they're all going to talk about Jesus, you know, like all this stuff really happened. Because we have lots of other people, Romans and Jewish historians, who tell us about the same events, and they don't have any vested interest in whether or not these things are actually true. Based on these Roman and Jewish sources from the same time, roughly within about 100 years, and based on these things only, if we're not even going to go to the Gospels at all, here's what you can learn about Jesus and the early church. You can learn his name, Jesus. You can learn the place and the time of his ministry within about 10 years under the same Roman governor. You can find out the name of his mother. You can learn that his birth was ambiguous in nature and questionable. You can learn that he had a brother named James, that he was famous as a teacher and a miracle worker, that people labeled him as the Messiah. Some people considered him to be a king, that he was executed by crucifixion around the time of Passover, that Romans and Jewish leaders were involved in executing him, that there was an eclipse at the time of his crucifixion, that Jesus appeared to his disciples, or at least that there was reports that he had appeared to his disciples after being crucified, and that there was a very fast-growing movement that appeared very quickly after Jesus' death that worshipped him as a god. Those are all the things that you can learn without ever having to open the Bible, based on Roman and Jewish historical documents. People just talking about Jesus and these weird Christians who worship this guy who was crucified. So even apart from the Gospels, we can learn a lot about Jesus, central events of Jesus' life and ministry. And we can at least learn that people thought that he rose from the dead. So, based on all of what I've just said, the Gospels are authentic. We have the original Gospels. And the Gospels are reliable. They seem to be telling us the historical truth. I think, and I suggest now, that their main central climaxing event, the resurrection, really happened. They're telling us the historical truth when they tell us that Jesus rose from the dead bodily and permanently. John Feinberg points to four different questions that have to be answered if we're going to really prove that Jesus rose from the dead, if we're going to deal with different objections that people bring up, saying, well, that, you know, here's another reason that we can explain the fact that people thought Jesus rose from the dead. So these are the four questions, and these are printed on your outline. We have to prove that Jesus really died, that Jesus was buried in a known, specific tomb. You know, people didn't just go to the wrong tomb and it happened to be empty, and they thought, wow, Jesus must be back from the dead. Number three, Jesus' body was not stolen. And fourth, Jesus really did appear to people after his death in the body, not just in dreams or visions. So the first point of this evidence that Jesus really rose from the dead, he really did die. Jesus did not just faint or go into a coma, as many people will try to argue. A Roman centurion, the Gospels tell us, oversaw Jesus' crucifixion. A centurion was a high-ranking officer in the Roman army. This was not a rookie. This was not his first day on the job. And as such, he was well-versed in death and in crucifixion. Crucifixion was a common form of execution by the Romans. So a centurion who is overseeing a crucifixion would have had experience knowing when people actually died from it. He would not have been foolish. Furthermore, the local leaders, Jewish and Roman, had a vested interest in making sure that Jesus really died because he was causing so much trouble for both of them. He was causing trouble for the Romans and he was causing trouble for the Jews. They had to make sure that Jesus really died. They knew that he had been promising that he would come back from the dead, and they wanted to make sure that that couldn't be claimed after the fact. So they really wanted to make sure he died. Finally, we know that Jesus really died because John, in John 19:34, tells us that a Roman soldier, as Jesus has died, to make sure that he's really going to die, goes and stabs him in the side with a spear. And John gives us this really interesting little detail. He says that when the soldier does this, blood and water gushes out of Jesus' side together. We now know, and they would not have known this in the ancient world, but now, because of our medical research and technology, we know that what that is a ruptured heart, that the heart has filled with water. And that the fact that there's blood and water gushing out of Jesus' heart at the same time suggests that he has really died. Jesus is actually dead. He's not in a coma. He's not passed out. He's dead. Second, Jesus is buried in a specific tomb that people knew about and remembered. His disciples didn't accidentally go to the wrong tomb on Sunday morning and assume he had come back. We know this because the Gospels tell us that a specific person requests to bury Jesus' body after he dies in his own tomb that he has just purchased. He's a rich man. named Joseph of Arimathea. He wants Jesus' body, and out of respect, he wants to bury him in a tomb that's just been made for himself. Also, the same women who witnessed Jesus' death are also the women who witness his resurrection. It is extremely unlikely that this man who owned the tomb and that these women who watched him die and be buried would have forgotten where that tomb was in 2 days. Yes, they were filled with grief. Yes, they were deeply disappointed that Jesus had died, but there's really no good reason to believe that they would have just forgotten where he was buried. Finally, there were Roman guards stationed at Jesus' tomb. Because the leaders knew that Jesus had promised to come back from the dead, they really wanted to make sure that the disciples would not just come and steal the body and claim that Jesus came back. So we know that Jesus was buried at a certain tomb, and a known tomb, because guards were stationed there, and that it was sealed with a Roman seal. Jesus was buried in a specific tomb. He really died, and he was buried in a tomb that people knew about. Third, Jesus was not stolen by his disciples. His body was not snatched away so that they could claim later that he really came back. Besides the fact that the tomb was guarded by Roman soldiers who were experienced, who would have probably been able to deal with any disciples who wanted to come and steal his body, or maybe even grave robbers, the fact is that all of these disciples went on to suffer terrible deaths, claiming that Jesus rose from the dead. Under torture, none of them broke down and said, well, okay, I'll tell you where the body is, or, oh, okay, please stop torturing me. We actually just stole it, and I'm sorry. No, none of them did that. They all died horrible deaths, and they lived very, very difficult lives. There is no evidence that Jesus' disciples were insane or that they were incredibly stupid. Why would Jesus' disciples continue leading and promoting a religion at great personal cost to themselves that they knew was a lie? Jesus' body was not stolen. Fourthly, Jesus really did appear in the body to hundreds of witnesses at different times after his death. In 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul says that Jesus appeared to him and to the other disciples and to over 500 people. And Paul wrote 1 Corinthians only 15 years after Jesus died and rose again. Paul knows that some of these people are still alive, and it's as if he's telling the Corinthians, who live over in Greece, saying, if you don't believe me, you can go talk to some of these people. They saw Jesus, and they talked to him. There's hundreds of them. You can go find them. But, perhaps, as is one common explanation, all of these people were hallucinating. They were full of grief. They were really hoping that Jesus would come back from the dead, and so they were having visions, or they were hallucinating, or they were in some kind of religious ecstasy, and they thought they were seeing Jesus, but they really weren't. This is extremely unlikely. First of all, because hallucinations are highly individualistic, and because hallucinations are built upon past experiences and current expectations. The same hallucination does not occur to different people at different times. This doesn't make any sense that hundreds and hundreds of people would have the same exact hallucination at different times. Furthermore, many first century Jews did believe in a kind of bodily resurrection. They were looking forward to a future resurrection when all of God's people would be raised from the dead. But that was the only resurrection they believed in. Nobody believed that one person would be resurrected before everybody else. They were not expecting this at all. And you see this as you read in the Gospels. Jesus tells his disciples, I'm going to come back from the dead. And they're saying, what? What is he talking about? It's a very strange idea to them. Ancient people did not just naively believe that people could come back from the dead. Sometimes we can look back because we have iPhone 6s and we can say, wow, ancient people are so stupid. They don't know anything. We're so smart. We know that people don't come back from the dead, but they were all a bunch of idiots. They didn't know anything. They were not idiots. They knew that death was permanent and final. Many of them were much more experienced and faced with death much more often than most of us are in our culture, where thankfully we have long life expectancy and we can go to doctors and be helped. Death was a very present reality for them. They knew that people did not come back from the dead. Thus, it is extremely unlikely that hundreds of Jesus' disciples would hallucinate and fantasize about Jesus coming back from the dead. They were not expecting that at all. Thus, I suggest that Jesus really did appear to his disciples in the body after he died. Jesus really died. Jesus was placed into a tomb that was known, his disciples did not steal his body, and he really did appear in the body to hundreds of people after he died. We have great evidence to believe that Jesus really did come back from the dead. I've argued that the Gospels are reliable in telling us that, in telling us who Jesus was and what his life was like and how he died and how he came back from the dead. And consequently, that we should believe the Gospels. We should take them seriously. In a world that is agitated over Ebola and worried about terrorism and anxious over aging, the Christian church declares that Jesus has defeated death. Death is the master of our world, no matter what model iPhone we have. In the end, death destroys all of our hopes. Death destroys all the hopes of all the other masters that we enslave ourselves to. Some people are enslaved by sex. Some people are enslaved by money. Some people are enslaved by family. But in the end, death masters all of them. Death takes everything from us. So if Jesus has mastered death by returning from the grave, then the world has a new master. If that is true, if Jesus really is the master of death, which so far has been the master of history, then we must change the way we think about Jesus and the way we think about the scriptures that speak about him. We must turn to Jesus and submit to him, the world's true master, lest we continue to hurtle toward the never-ending death that Jesus warned us about, so that we can receive the never-ending life that he offers us. Jesus promises us rescue from death. He has mastered death. I'm going to pray, and then we'll sing. Father, we love you, and we are so thankful that you have sent Jesus to rescue us from death. We have our iPhones, and we have our healthcare systems, and we have our cars, but in the end, death will kill us all. Help us to remember that you are our only hope. We thank you that you have revealed yourself to us in Jesus and that you have inspired apostles to write about him accurately for us. I pray especially for people here who are not sure if Jesus is who he said he was or if the Bible is reliable. I pray for those of us here who have friends who aren't sure, who are doubting. I pray that you would speak to them and show them that Jesus really is who the New Testament says he is, and that they would find life and hope and meaning in him. We pray these things in his name. Amen.